This is going to be an important lecture today. To my mind, it's actually the most important lecture in the course. Why? Because it's not just about the substantive issue that we're concerned with in this part of the course, namely the whole problem of the origins of the First World War. It's about something more basic. It's about how do you go up making up your mind? How do you go about making up your mind for yourself about what to believe? Right? You can't, if you really want to understand something, if you really want to reach conclusions about a certain problem, you can't just trust what other people say. I mean, so much of your education has kind of programmed you to kind of believe what you're told, believe what you read. You know, just look at the whole structure of this room. You know, with me up here spouting and you there taking notes. That's not real learning. You can't just be a sponge. You need some method, some way to reach conclusions that you yourself are very comfortable with, that you have real confidence in. Right? And there is this method. Right? You learn the method by seeing how it works in practice. And once you learn that method, it puts you in control, it puts you in the driver's seat. Right? So you really can assess arguments. You can make up your mind for yourself about what to believe. Right? So it's a value for that reason. It enables you to take your measure of various claims that people make. But more than that, and this is why this whole method is so nice, more than that, just in the process of assessing other people's arguments, you automatically reach conclusions of your own. You know? To me, it's like almost a magical process. This is how you reach conclusions, by looking at various claims that people make. It's like you're a juror in some sort of law case. You hear the argument of defense, you hear the argument of the prosecution, and you weigh the different arguments against each other in the light of the evidence that you're presented with, and you reach your conclusions. All right? Well, that's just very abstract. So you only get a grasp of that method by seeing how it works in practice. Now, we did this once before in this course when we looked at those different arguments about the origins of the Franco-Prussian War and whether Bismarck deliberately set out to engineer a war with France. And we saw the Aflanta argument, and we saw the Craig argument, and we looked at some of the evidence that was presented in both cases. And there were some very striking things there, such as the fact that Craig cited that Halperin article in support of his point of view, whereas Halperin basically was making the other kind of argument. You know, those kinds of things are very revealing. Right? But today we're going to be dealing with something that's actually a lot more important than that, and that's the whole question of the origins of the First World War. As you recall, last time I talked about these different interpretations that people have. A lot of people think that the First World War was a war of German aggression. That notion that Germany deliberately set out to engineer at least the Continental War, maybe a war including Britain as well, in order to establish German hegemony over Europe, this is accepted by a number of leading political scientists, most notably by John Mearsheimer in that book that I've talked about a number of times, The Tragedy of Great Power Politics. Important piece of evidence from Mearsheimer in support of his general argument about how great power politics works. Right. It's an important argument because it's presented as the principal alternative to this inadvertent war argument. The idea that You know, people were just overwhelmed by forces they couldn't control. The First World War was, in some sense, an accidental war brought on by the workings of the military system. Well, if the argument that Germany deliberately contrived to engineer great European wars correct, well, that alternative argument about the First World War being brought on, accidentally by the workings of the military system would have to be dismissed, right? So it's important for all kinds of reasons. And suppose you wanted to assess it. How would you go about doing it? Is this like, learning German and plunging into the sources and spending a lifetime doing that? No, that's not a viable way. It's not a realistic way. It's not even an effective way. A much better way is to kind of look at those places where that argument has been developed in greatest depth, and then analyze that argument in terms of both of its internal logic and in terms of the adequacy of the evidence supporting it. Those are the two great tests. And so you want to see who has made this argument, who is always cited as the principal champion of that point of view. It's not hard to find. Look at any historical works or even political science works like the Mearsheimer book. It's a German historian named Fritz Fischer who, beginning in the early 1960s, published these massive volumes in which he made the argument that the German government deliberately engineered the war. Okay? Huge volumes. This first book in Germany was called Germany's Reach for World Power. In English, it had a much milder title, Germany's Aims in the First World War, when it was translated. Huge book. And then that was followed up with a second book, number of years later, called War of Illusions. Another huge book. What are you supposed to do? Just read these books from cover to cover, just trying to absorb whatever you can? No, you have to read in a much, much more active way. You have to kind of identify the specific places in those books where that argument is made. Identify, flesh out the argument. In other words, not just see the specific general point that's made, but understand the specific claims that are used to support that general point so that you can examine those specific claims in the light of the evidence that author himself presents. Right? You see, and the reason why this approach is so effective is, if you're forced to read these 600-page books, where do you start? It's like, how do you get a handle on it? Is that too massive? It makes much more sense to zero in on those places within those books where the argument is developed. And in fact, you don't have to read the whole books, the whole book in either case, because in each of those books, only a single chapter deals with the July crisis. The first chapter in the Germany's Aims in the First World War book, and it's the last chapter in the War of Illusions book, which deals with the pre-war period. But even that, do you have to read each of those chapters in great detail? No. Because when you see what the argument is, it enables you to zero in on specific sections within those chapters, which have to be crucial to support the argument. And those sections, being relatively short, can be read with very great care and in the light of the evidence that the author presents. All right. So how do you go about? So your first job is to identify the specific claims that are being made, right? Because you want to get a sense for what the structure of the argument is. So where do you look? Are these claims, would you expect these claims to just be scattered around at random in the text of these chapters? No. An author can't do it that way. An author has to present his or her fundamental argument in places where people are going to notice it. Right? You know, and where are you going to notice it? Well, when you still are paying attention to what the author is saying, at the very beginning of the chapter, at the very beginning of a section, titles of chapters, the conclusion of the chapter, the last paragraph of the chapter, last paragraph in a section. Where everything is supposed to be pulled together. So, you tell the reader what you claim you've shown. And so those are the first things you look at. Instead of reading it from cover to cover, you look at the beginning, you look at the end, you look at the first and last sentences, first and last paragraphs in each section. And what do you find in the case of Fisher? I hope you remember to bring in the course pack today, because I'm going to be referring to this a lot and talking about these things. What do you find? Well, for example, in the War of Illusions book, the very last paragraph in the chapter that deals with the coming of the war in 1914. It's crucial. The very last paragraph in this crucial chapter, it's on page 515 in the book. Look at the very first sentence in that concluding paragraph. In spite of Britain's entry into the war, the plan decided on a month previously to use the favorable opportunity of the murder at Sarajevo for the start of the continental war, which Germany regarded as necessary, was carried out successfully. We see the important thing here is he's not simply telling you as a flat claim Germany engineered the war. He's fleshing it out. He's saying they came up with a plan. They came up with this plan at the start of the crisis. They deliberately decided to engineer a war. Right? This is a war they viewed as necessary. All of those claims, they're promises to you as a reader. The promise is he's going to prove these things. Right? He's going to give you evidence to support it. And then so you when you read the text, you approach the text with that question in mind. Does he prove it? Does he support it? And that question, it serves to throw into relief the things that you're interested in, the things that bear on that fundamental. Right? It's like a chemical stain that you spread on a biological specimen. It throws into relief. It makes salient the things that are going to enable you to judge that argument as a whole. Is that the only place? Take a look at 470 in that same book. The chapter is divided up into these two sections. The first section ends on page 470. And again, at the very, very end of that section, the last two sentences in that section. There is no doubt that the war which the German politicians started in July 1914, they started it, they engineered it, right? Was not a preventive war fought out of fear and despair. It was an attempt to defeat the enemy powers before they became too strong, and to realize Germany's political ambitions, which may be summed up as German hegemony over Europe. Germany is reaching for hegemony. This is very much in line with the kind of a Mearsheimer theory of how things work. Right? What else? Look at page 480. Again, there's a section that begins on page 480. The very first sentence in that section. Again, Fisher says, while the German government was determined from early July 1914 onwards to use this favorable opportunity for a war against France and Russia. They're determined. They make this decision at the very start of the crisis. And it's not just in those crucial places that he makes it clear what his argument is. It's even in the text itself, he often says things which are in line with that general interpretation of what was going on there. An example of this is on page 494. And this is about, it's the very end of the paragraph that you find at the top of that page, about the 10th line or so on that page. When he refers to the decision taken in early July to start the war at this moment in time. They consciously decided to start a war. The decision was made at the beginning of July. Okay? So he's taking this general argument. He's giving it some concrete content. You know? They decided to start a war at a particular point in time. Now suppose you wanted to examine that claim. Where would you look? Would you just scour the entire chapter looking for evidence about it? No. He says the decision was made at a particular point in time. At the beginning of July. The book, the chapter basically has a kind of chronological structure. So you look at the part of the chapter that deals with that particular point in time. Not hard to find if you're just looking at the titles of each section. So what section would you want to look at? Not hard to guess. Page 473. Okay? Title of the section there, you find on page 473. The occasion is propitious. The first week in July. Right? Given the way he himself has fleshed out his argument, right? He's basically saying, if you want to examine this argument, look at this particular section. You say, what's nice about this is this section is only about 6 pages long. It might be very hard to read, you know, these 2 600-page books to try and assess an argument. But by using this method, you kind of boil it down. It directs your attention to something that's very specific. You can very easily go through those six pages and see whether he in fact proves his point that the German government decided at the beginning, in the first week of July, to take advantage of this propitious occasion to engineer a general European war. Right? Very specific question. And it's targeted on a very narrow part of the book, just 6 pages of text. Okay. So you look at this argument. This is the direct argument, he's saying. The German leadership consciously decided to engineer a war. That's what he says at this particular point, first week in July. Does he give the evidence to prove it? Well, when you're writing, the very first thing you cite has to be pretty important. Because if you blow it, if you give evidence that doesn't really prove your point, then the reader kind of loses the faith in you. So the very first piece of evidence, you know, should be pretty compelling. And he does give a piece of evidence there. It's the report of a meeting that a German journalist named Victor Naumann had with the Austrian leadership at the beginning of the crisis. And this, in fact, is one of the 3 documents that I gave you in the bulk pack for you to read, because read Fischer's paraphrase of this document, then you read the document itself, and you say, is this paraphrase a fair accounting of what was actually said? All right. What do you want to zero in on this? Because the section, the occasion is propitious, is extremely important in terms of supporting Fischer's general argument that Germany engineered the war. Right. And this is the very first document that he presents in that section. So, You see, this is like the basic technique of doing this kind of analysis. You start with these kind of very general things about what makes for war, or how international politics works, the Mearsheimer argument about states reaching for hegemony, and so on. You look at what the historical evidence that supports that is, this argument about Germany engineering war in 1914 as a way of achieving hegemony in Europe. This is a very important case to support that argument. And then you say, well, what's the basis for that argument? Well, there's a specific claim that the German government decided at the very start of July to engineer this war. And then the question is, well, what's the evidence that the German government did that? Well, we had the first piece of evidence, presumably an important piece of evidence, because otherwise it wouldn't be first, is this now non-document. So you look at the document in light of the evidence. So it's not just isolated nitpicking when we're going to do this stuff. It's not just kind of taking pot shots at it, because you've understood the whole structure of the argument. By zeroing in on these things that are crucial, you're going to get some insight into the validity of the argument as a whole and the validity of the general theoretical superstructure that it's connected with. Okay, so what does Fisher say there at the bottom of page 473 about this Naumann document? How's this Naumann document supposed to support this general claim? Right? So you read what he says, and you read that in conjunction with the text of the document itself, which, as I say, I gave you on the course pack. It comes right after the two Fisher pieces. Naumann was, he says, in conversations with Berchtold, the Austrian foreign minister, and Hoyos, who was an official in the Austrian foreign ministry, Naumann tried to convince the Austro-Hungarian politicians that if Austria-Hungary wanted to live, it must destroy Serbia. Vienna must present the idea to Berlin in a suitable form. He was sure, now this is a key passage from him. He was sure that, unlike the year before, not only the military, but also the foreign ministry and the emperor no longer objected to a preventive war against Russia, and that public opinion would moreover force the government into a war. And then he goes on, and he says, in the foreign ministry, the moment was considered propitious for the great decision. Right? You see why this is important? Look at the title of the section. You know, the occasion is propitious, the moment is propitious for the great decision. You know, context of that, what's the antecedent of that, the great decision? Yeah, for war against Russia. Naumann warned that if Austria-Hungary failed to use this opportunity, Germany would drop Austria as an ally. Naumann's line of argument was the same as that of the foreign ministry in the days and weeks ahead. All right. So you look at the document. Is this a fair paraphrase? Anyone could do this sort of thing. You know, just the question of looking at the Fisher's paraphrase and then reading the actual document itself. And what do you find when you read the actual document itself? Do you find Naumann saying he was sure that, unlike the year before, not only the military but also the foreign ministry and the emperor no longer objected to a preventive war against Russia, and that public opinion would moreover force the government into a war? Do you find this? Well, he comes closest to it. The sentence that comes closest to supporting that is kind of about the sixth or seventh line in the document itself, where Hoyos paraphrases Naumann as saying that he himself, Naumann, had observed that not only in army and navy circles, but also in the foreign ministry, the idea of a preventive war against Russia was regarded with less disfavor than a year ago. All right, number one, less disfavor is a lot weaker than no longer objected. Number two, nothing here about the emperor. Okay? Anything about public opinion forcing the government into a war against Russia? Very hard to see. Certainly not in that passage. anything about in the foreign ministry, the occasion was considered propitious for the great decision. Which great decision? Okay. Oh, I should say the whole business about public opinion would moreover force the government to a war. That seems to be to refer to the very last sentence in the report of the meeting with Naumann. Now, Naumann has tried to influence all the German press to be anti-Serbian and thinks that public opinion in Germany will force the Auswärtigesamt, the German Foreign Office, to support us. It's very different from a war against Russia. This is to support Austria in a war against Serbia. Those two things are not the same thing. Yeah, the Germans wanted Austria to move against Serbia, right? That's not the same as saying the Germans want to use this as a pretext for engineering a general European war. Okay. The whole business about the occasion is propitious. That refers to a passage toward the end of the of this document. Where Naumann says that the Foreign Office, Foreign Ministry, regards this as the favorable moment for bringing about the great decision. What in context there is the great decision? The context is a war of Austria against Serbia, for Austria to make this great decision to, you know, solve the Serbian problem by crushing Serbia. Right? Not a war against Russia. Okay? A bit of a problem. Okay? Now, my document doesn't really support the point, does it? That the German government had decided to engineer a great continental war in the first week in July. Well, you may say, that's just the first document. Maybe he just kind of got carried away. The section is not very long, and so you kind of go through it trying to see whether he gives any other hard evidence to the effect that the German government deliberately decided to engineer a war. Okay? And he returns to the theme again a couple of pages later, 475. Various pieces of evidence from the week between the murder at Sarajevo and the Austrian ambassador's audience with William II, that's to say this first week in July, show that Berlin government circles thought the moment was opportune for a European war. Well, what's the evidence? What's the evidence? The military wants it, but what about the political leadership? The very document he cites reports the view of its author that he couldn't imagine the emperor being inveigled into a war. Right. And then he talks about how people in the Foreign Office thought that Germany was in good shape militarily. Right. The fact that Germany's in good shape militarily doesn't mean that Germans felt now's the time for war. It could mean we can get away with a political victory because the other side's going to back down because we're strong and they're weak. Right? So the mere point about what the military balance is doesn't necessarily prove in itself that the Germans wanted a war. Okay? What else? The bottom of that same page, another report says that the general staff thinks it wouldn't be so bad if there was a war now. But the author of this report also thought that the emperor wanted to preserve the peace. And then Fisher goes on to say that this is wrong. William II's marginalia of the same day on a report from Chirsky, who was their ambassador in Vienna, show that this rumor was false. It was false that William II wanted to preserve peace with Russia.
Okay. Now or never, we must make a clean sweep of the Serbs and so on. This is another document that I gave you in the course pack. Okay. William II did in fact scribble in the margin of this report from their ambassador to Austria, now or never. We must. But what was the now or never about? Fisher wants you to believe that the now or never had to do with a war against Russia. That's the context. That's the subtitle of the chapter. Germany and the start of the war. Now or never. What was the now or never about? Well, it's quite clear from the document itself that William II is talking about a settlement of accounts between Serbia and Austria, not between Germany and Russia, right? They wanted this, you know, the Austrians to move against Serbia, to solve that Serbian problem through force. They wanted that, now or never. But that in itself doesn't mean that they wanted a general European war, see? And it's only by playing fast and loose with you and taking things which apply to an Austrian move against Serbia, now or never, and leading you to believe that it actually applies to a general European war, that Fisher can make his case that Germany wanted to engineer a European war. I mean, this is serious stuff. This is cheating with evidence. Anything else? Anything else that would be kind of direct evidence that Germany wanted a war? Well, in the other book, the Germany's Aims in the First World War book, he gives what purports to be a piece of evidence to support this claim. It's on page 59, and this relates to the third document that I gave you to read. This is a letter from the German foreign minister, his name was Yagov, to their ambassador in London, Lichnowsky, which Fischer on page 60 of that book says, sums up the German attitude in a nutshell. And once again, what do you find? You find him paraphrasing this document to make you believe that this is really an argument for preventive war. He wants you to believe that the Germans thought war with Russia is inevitable, that being the case, better now than later. And this is how he paraphrases it. He has Yagov saying, the struggle between Teuton and Slav was bound to come, which being so, the present was the best moment for Germany, for in a few years Russia will be ready, then she will crush us on land by weight of numbers, and she will have her Baltic fleet and her strategic railways ready. Our group, meanwhile, is getting steadily weaker. Does Yagov say things like that? Well, to a certain extent, he says, yeah, our strategic position is deteriorating. We're strong now, we'll be weak later. But does he use that as an argument for provoking a war? No, exactly the opposite. He uses this as an argument to support the view that the other side won't act now. They'll be strong later, they're weak now. They have no interest in bringing matters to a head now. Their interest is putting them over. Therefore, we can get away with a tough line now. Right? This is an argument to support the German government's view that what they called a localization of the crisis was still possible. Russia won't come in now. Russia is still weak. And he says specifically in the document that he still thinks localization is possible. Does he say that a conflict between Teuton and Slav is inevitable? No, all he says is that the feeling of the Slavic element within Russia is becoming stronger. Again, much weaker. Right? You get the sense of He wants to convince you of this argument. He's going to pull out all the stops. He's going to misrepresent evidence. Right? So the direct argument fails. The direct argument, the fact that you're going to find some sort of smoking gun that shows the Germans have deliberately decided to engineer a war, it fails. But does that mean that no argument at all can be made? No, because there's also an indirect argument that can be made. What's the indirect argument? Well, you can, as you read this whole, these chapters, you're kind of struck over and over again by the way Fisher conflates these two issues. The whole question of, did Germany want Austria to move against Serbia? Did Germany want an Austro-Serbian war, on the one hand? With the much more important issue of did Germany want a general European war? And he simply assumes that all this evidence to show that the Germans really wanted to Austria to have a showdown with Serbia, that in itself proves that Germany really wanted was a general European war. And so you say to yourself, how can you make that leap? What additional assumption do you need that will enable you to go from the correct point that Germany was pushing Austria to move against Serbia to the point that Fischer wants to establish, which is that what Germany really wanted was a general European war? What additional assumption do you need to kind of cover that gap? Well, in logic, it's quite simple. It's like, they understood that localization was not in the cards. They understood that there was no way in which Russia was going to stand aside. And that if Russia wasn't going to stand aside, France wouldn't stand aside. Maybe Britain, but probably not. Okay. See? They understood that provoking a showdown between Austria and Serbia, what they really were, you know, what this really would mean is that you're going to have a general European war, because there was no way that the Russians would disinterest in themselves in the fate of Serbia. Right? You can see that in logic, that's something he has to say. He has to make that case in logic. If he's going to have any chance of establishing that what Germany really wanted was a European war. And so with that basic point in mind, you kind of then go back and scour the evidence and see, are there any points in which Fisher actually makes that claim? And, you know, that the Germans knew there's no chance that Russia would stand aside. And in fact, he does say this thing. He says it on page 63 of the Germany's Aims in the First World War chapter. At the very bottom of that page, the paragraph that begins at the bottom of that page, he says, yet, as innumerable documents show, Germany knew that Russia would never allow Austria-Hungary to act in the Balkans unopposed. Right? They knew that Russia was bound to come in. They knew that localization was not a real possibility. Right? Now, that topic sentence in that paragraph in about innumerable documents, again, he's making a promise to you. If there are innumerable documents, he should present at least one of them. We know that Russia is bound to come in. We know there's no chance that Austria will be allowed to deal with Serbia by herself. We know that by pushing Austria to move against Serbia, what we're really doing is triggering a general European war. Right? And so, as you read that paragraph, you zero in on that paragraph, you say, well, are there any of these innumerable documents that are cited here? He's in effect promising to cite some. But does he? Does he give you a single document? Well, what are the documents that he cites? What do they show? The very first one. This is confirmed by the preparations taken by Germany when the ultimatum was presented to Serbia. Jagow, for example, asked for the exact itinerary of the imperial yacht because, And then we have this block quote at the top of page 64. Since we want to localize the conflict between Austria and Serbia, we must not have the world alarmed by His Majesty's returning prematurely. On the other hand, His Majesty must be within reach in case unpredictable developments should force us to take important decisions such as mobilization. His Majesty might perhaps spend the last days of his cruise in the Baltic. Right? That proves, that's one of the innumerable documents that prove that the Germans know that Russia is bound to come in. He begins by saying that, you know, talking about localization as something that's a real possibility. He recognizes, of course, that there's a chance that the localization strategy won't work and that Russia might come in. Right? Germans understand there's a chance of it, but that doesn't mean that they think that there's a high probability of it, or that, let alone that it's a certainty. The same point applies to the evidence that follows that. They just want to make sure that if things develop in a way that they don't like, they're prepared. They're prepared to deal with European complications. But it doesn't mean that they didn't believe that there was a good chance that the war could be kept localized. As a matter of fact, a large part of the argument for pushing Austria to move rapidly against Serbia was to make the localization strategy more viable before the other powers really had a chance to commit themselves. Okay. Well, you can press this kind of issue a bit further. And you can say, well, wasn't it kind of an obvious political reality? You know, that anyone who had any experience with great power politics in this period would know that Russia would have to come in. That would know that Russia couldn't allow Austria to just crush Serbia and for Russia just standing on the sidelines as an observer. Well, with that question in mind, you can then go through the Fisher text and ask what he shows about Russian policy. Was it the case that Russia was bound to come in, was bound to intervene militarily in the event that Austria moved against Serbia militarily? Right? And here, there's a passage that's relevant to all this. It's in the War of Illusions book on page 489. And this is where he's talking about what Russian policy was. What was Russian policy? Well into the crisis. This is July 24th, July 25th. At a meeting of the Russian Ministerial Council, the Russian Foreign Minister, Sazonov, he had made certain proposals which were approved. And one of the proposals was that Serbia was to be advised that if Austrian troops entered Serb territory, it should, to begin with, offer no resistance but withdraw its troops. In fact, and if you look up the document itself, it doesn't even say to begin with. It basically says Serbia is to be advised that if Austrian troops invade Serbia, Serbia is not to resist, but rather to trust her fate to the judgment of the great powers. Well, this throws an interesting light on the question, doesn't it? What it means is that it's by no means certain that localization would not have worked. It's by no means certain that Russia felt bound to intervene militarily as soon as Austria moved militarily against Serbia. Right? So if you put yourself in this kind of critical mode, see, and you think through the structure of the problem, and you think through what the assumptions have to be that underlie this type of argument, you're then in the position with a prepared mind to see the importance of evidence that Fisher himself gives, which tend to run counter to his general argument. Okay. Yes. Yeah?
Why would he have given
it? Because he's making a case.
Isn't it like kind of contrary to what he's trying to
prove? Oh, I see. Why would he give? Well, this is often the case. In a sense, this is a measure of a certain degree of honesty. You often find this where people are doing historical work, that they're just presenting the evidence because they're telling a story. It's as though they switch from one mode to another. One mode is the argument mode. The other mode is just presenting evidence, right? And often people aren't aware of the fact that the evidence that they present contradicts their basic claims, right? It's a measure of their honesty, if not of their intelligence. Okay. So what do we have here? We have this argument that Germany, they may have hoped for localization, but they understood that there was a risk of European complications. Right? Yes. Does this mean that they were guilty, in quotes? Well, couldn't you make that argument about all of these powers? None of them are pacifists. They all are pursuing policies. The whole premise of a policy is if it's tested, you're willing to use force. So how was Germany different? And here what's interesting is to look at the very last page in the Germany's Aims book, page 92, where Fisher talks about Germany's real guilt. Germany's real guilt. You know what he says Germany's real guilt was? Her constant overestimation of her own powers and her misjudgment of realities. The Germans thought they were stronger than they actually were. Right? This is an argument that Germany's guilt turns on the mismatch between what Germany was trying to do and what the underlying power realities in Europe were. But think about that argument. What if Germany had won the war? It was not out of the question that Germany could have won the war if they hadn't launched the submarine war against the United States and so on. America might not have come in and Germany might have ended up prevailing. If Germany had won the war, then you could say the Entente was guilty because they were the ones who overestimated their capabilities. You're making a judgment based on power realities? The loser is always wrong? Is that the sort of argument you want to make? You say, well, Russia was guilty by that token, because Russia also lost the war. Russia was defeated in the war. So Russia overestimated her own power position. You want to make that kind of argument? So what's the bottom line here? I'll just end with the basic points that I made at the outset. There's a method here for getting to the bottom of these things. The method is reading things actively, reading things closely, reading things carefully with an eye to the structure of arguments. First, you identify the argument, the core argument, and then you see how it's supported. You know, what are the specific claims, the concrete claims that an author makes to support these general conclusions. Then you zero in on the parts of the text that relate to those specific claims, and you analyze those passages very closely with an eye to the evidence that's presented there. Right? Even if the author's paraphrase is correct, does it really support the author's point? And is the author's paraphrase, in fact, correct? If it isn't, then it undermines your faith in the argument. And why is this important? Because Fisher's not just any minor historian. This argument had enormous repercussions. It's still taken very, very seriously. You know, this is considered a very important work of scholarship. And if you reach the judgment that, you know, the argument really has not been made effectively, then you say, if even Fisher has not been able to make an effective argument, well, maybe there's no effective argument to be made. Maybe you really can't, you know, prove that Germany caused the war. And then that forces you to then think, if this was not a war of German aggression, pure and simple, then what was it? It opens your mind to other kinds of interpretations. One of which is this interpretation that the war came about, even though no one wanted it, because people were overwhelmed by all these forces that they didn't control. Right? So that's the next basic set of arguments that we want to deal with, and that's what I'm going to be talking about next time, the inadvertent war.